Today is Tuesday, March 16th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Congress's top GOP goes after President Biden's COVID success claims.
Point by point on the Senate floor, McConnell took on the president's statements in last week's primetime address.
Also, Kenya refuses a UN meeting over maritime dispute with Somalia.
The maritime hearing at the Hague-based International Court of Justice, or ICJ, began with a conspicuous no-show.
Plus, a report on the secondary effects of the COVID pandemic. These stories and more are next. Congress's top Republican is going after President Biden's claim of success in the virus fight. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Yesterday, the president said his administration's within reach of a big milestone in his first 100 days.
100 million shots in people's arms.
It didn't impress Senate GOP chief Mitch McConnell.
A million shots per day was just the pace that the Biden administration actually inherited.
Point by point on the Senate floor, McConnell took on the president's statements in last week's primetime address from when all adults will be eligible for vaccines.
No later than May 1.
Dr. Fauci said a month ago we'd be there by April.
To when Americans can gather in small groups.
July 4th with your loved ones is the goal.
Current CDC guidelines say it is already safe, right now. For fully vaccinated people to meet in small groups.
McConnell says the president is out of touch.
The country is not locked down, waiting for July the 4th.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin held talks with their Japanese counterparts in Tokyo Tuesday to reaffirm the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the face of an increasingly assertive China and hostile North Korea.
I'm pleased to be in Japan on my first international trip as Secretary of Defense. The U.S.-Japan alliance is strong, and I look forward to charting a path towards continued success in the future. It is especially meaningful that I'm here so close to the 10th anniversary of the 3/11 Great East Japan earthquake. It was a terrible event that we responded to hand in hand as the closest of allies, exemplified in the spirit of Operation Tomodachi. I'd also like to offer my condolences for the tragic incident that in February where both of our nations lost two young service members near Montgomery, Alabama, as you mentioned. These young men embodied the hope, the promise, and patriotism so common in the people of our two countries, and our hearts go out to both of their families. Without question, the U.S.-Japan alliance remains the cornerstone in addressing today's and tomorrow's challenges as we work together to uphold a free and open Indo-Pacific.
That's U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Diyan said on Tuesday that cooperation between Japan and the U.S. should not harm the interests of others in the region. This as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned China against using coercion and aggression as he sought to use his first trip abroad to shore up Asian alliances in the face of growing assertiveness by Beijing. China's extensive territorial claims in the East and South China Seas have become a priority issue in an increasing testy Sino-US relationship and are important security concerns for Japan. Washington has denounced what it called Beijing's attempt to bully neighbors with competing interests. China has condemned what it called U.S. efforts to foment unrest in the region and interfere in what it regards as its internal affairs. The sister of North Korean leader Kim Yo-jong criticized ongoing military drills in South Korea and warned the U.S. new administration against, quote, causing a stink, unquote, if it wants peace, State News reported on Tuesday. Lee Behogan of Reuters reports.
Kim Yo-jong, the sister of North Korea's leader, delivered a blunt message to the U.S. administration on Tuesday. A newsreader on state media relayed Kim's words, warning that the Biden White House was, quote, trying hard to give off gunpowder smell in our land, and that if the U.S. wants peace, it had better refrain from causing a stink. She also criticized the ongoing joint military drills in South Korea that kicked off last week. The timing of the comments coincides with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's trip to Asia this week. Their first stop has been Japan, where Blinken said he wanted to work with allies on the denuclearization of North Korea. North Korea has so far rejected U.S. attempts to engage in dialogue, the White House said on Monday, as a chill in relations that started under former President Trump extends into the current administration. Trump held three high-profile meetings with Kim Jong-un, but North Korea ended the talks and says it will not engage further unless the U.S. drops its hostile policies.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. The UN Secretary General has strongly condemned ongoing violence against peaceful protesters and what he called the continuing violation of the most basic human rights of the people of Myanmar. The Secretary General renewed his calls on the international community, including regional states, to come together in solidarity with the people of Myanmar and their democratic aspirations. According to the UN Human Rights Office, at least 138 peaceful protesters, including women and children, have been killed in the violence since February. This includes 38 people who were killed yesterday, the majority in the Halang Taya area of Yangon, while 18 people were killed on Saturday. Myanmar's junta declared martial law in several areas of the country's largest city Monday. The announcement coincided with additional protests and reported deaths. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with Zhao Zantar with VOA's Burmese service to get details.
So far, the decree of martial law is, yes, as you mentioned, some parts of Rangoon, the biggest city of Burma, and actually those are the most important and the most popular neighborhood of Rangoon. So very active and very aggressively opposing the military coup. So that is the widespread. I think it is, if the demonstration didn't stop and they are still getting bigger and bigger, the volume of the demonstration, and maybe this is likely to spread to some other places of the country. But the problem is, when the military junta, they throw the topple the government, they said, they claim that this is according to the constitution. So martial law means that is suspension of constitution. So there is a dilemma for them to impose martial law for the whole country. That is the problem. That's why they are trying to expand the martial law bit by bit.
John, what do we know about the number of people who have been killed during these protests? This past weekend saw the bloodiest set of protests with the greatest number of people killed. That extended into Monday. What can you tell us about the latest developments?
Yes. So far, according to our source, there are 182 people killed and a lot more wounded. And about 2,000 people are so far arrested. But there are some, there are maybe more, because we don't have an exact number of those who killed. So some places, the hunter, the soldiers, and the police tried to took the dead body away. So we cannot tell exact number of those killed. But the military hunter, what I can say is, first, they say that this is very, they are utmost restraint and not responding violently. But day by day, the protest is getting bigger and bigger, and the government has to respond very brutally and killing people.
That's my colleague, Steve Miller, speaking with Joe Zantar of VOA's Burmese service. Last week, the United States government designated two armed groups, one in the Democratic Republic of Congo and another in Mozambique, as terrorist organizations, resulting in travel bans and assets freezes. U.S. said the DRC-based Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, and the Mozambique-based Ahlu Sunnah wa Jamaa had links to the so-called Islamic State extremist group. For more, VOA's Jason Patenkin reached out to Dr. Akinlo Olojo in Dakar, Senegal. Dr. Olojo is counter-terrorism expert and a senior researcher with the South African-based Institute for Security Studies.
It has become very clear that these groups have become a threat, not only to the immediate communities where they operate, but also to the region. And I'm focusing very specifically on the countries where they operate, but also about the fact that it's perceived, of course, by the U.S. that they are also a threat to U.S. interests.
Now, looking at the ADF in Eastern Congo, they're accused of committing attacks against civilians. But of course, there are many armed groups in Eastern Congo who have been accused of atrocities. Why do you think the U.S. has decided to designate this group, the ADF, as a terrorist organization?
Okay, I will say that when we look at the details of the designation itself, it refers to, you know, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, Mozambique, ISIS Mozambique. You know, I'm quoting the exact language used in the designation. And it's framing it sort of within the context of this ISIS affiliation. And we've seen in recent years, you know, since, of course, the disintegration of ISIS in Iraq and Syria, a sort of spread, you know, in Africa. In the Sahel, for instance, you have the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. You have, of course, for some years now, the so-called Islamic State West Africa province in the Lake Chad Basin. That ISIS link or that nexus with ISIS is what really comes very clearly as a threat, perceived as a threat, of course, to the U.S. and countries affected in Africa.
That's Dr. Akinola Olojo, a counterterrorism expert and senior researcher with the South African-based Institute for Security Studies. He spoke with my colleague, Jason Patenkin, from Dakar. Meanwhile, International AIDS Group says northern Mozambique's humanitarian crisis is growing quickly, with more than 650,000 people displaced by the Islamic extremist insurgency in Cabo Delgado province. Workers for Save the Children, who interviewed grief-stricken families, reported Tuesday that children as young as 11 have been beheaded by the rebels. According to the UN, the number of displaced has shot up by more than 500,000 in the past year, and nearly 1 million people are in need of food aid. Kenya has refused to attend a week-long hearing by the United Nations highest court over a long-running maritime dispute with Somalia. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more on the case from Paris.
The seating is open. The court meets today to begin
the maritime hearing at the Hague-based International Court of Justice, or ICJ, began with a conspicuous no-show. In a letter last week to the ICJ, the Kenyan government cited a mix of reasons for not participating, including the COVID-19 pandemic that it said made it hard to adequately prepare and make its case. The court's president, Judge Joan Donoghue, rejected Kenya's request to brief it before the start of Monday's opening.
The court regrets the decision of Kenya not to participate in the oral proceedings.
But she said the court had a raft of material previously filed by the country in arguing its side of the case. Kenya's dispute with Somalia centers on some 100,000 square kilometers of Indian Ocean waters, rich in fish and possibly also oil and gas. Mogadishu argues its maritime border with Kenya should be extended along the same southeasterly line as its land border. Nairobi claims the frontier should head in a straight line east. Over the months, Kenya filed several requests for this hearing to be postponed, along with other demands. Presenting his country's opening arguments, Somalia's Deputy Prime Minister Mahdi Mohamed Guled described the dispute as of key national importance to his country.
We hoped that it would be possible to settle our dispute with Kenya bilaterally through negotiations. Unfortunately, that proved impossible.
The maritime spat adds to mounting diplomatic friction between the East African neighbors. In December, Mogadishu announced it was cutting ties with Kenya for allegedly meddling in its internal political affairs. It may take years for the ICJ to rule on the maritime dispute. It has no power to enforce its rulings. And in the past, some countries have simply ignored them. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is the Voice of America. Israeli archaeologists have announced the discovery of dozens of new Dead Sea Scrolls fragments bearing a biblical text. They were found in desert cave and were believed hidden during a Jewish revolt against Rome nearly 1,900 years ago. The fragments of parchment bears lines of Greek texts from the books of Zechariah and Nahum and have been radiocarbon dated to the 2nd century. The Vatican's edict that same-sex unions cannot be blessed because they are sinful has been met with criticism by right activists and gay Catholics in many parts of the world as inconsistent and out of step with contemporary community standards. A New Zealand lawmaker who sponsored the bill that in 2013 legalized gay marriages in the South Pacific country said the statement from the Vatican's Orthodoxy office seemed incongruent after Pope Francis's last expressed support for civil union law. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. While the world continues to reel from the coronavirus pandemic, the mere existence of effective vaccines has created hope for an end to a scourge that has already killed over 3 million people worldwide. However, the rollout has been uneven, and availability of the vaccine has skewed almost completely to a small number of wealthy and developed nations. Reasons for this inequity include what has been termed vaccine nationalism, whereby countries seek to vaccinate even its low-risk citizens before sharing their supplies with other countries. These and many related issues are addressed in a new wide-ranging report by the Council of Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Thomas Boyke, Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economic and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations and co-director of its independent task force on preparing for the next pandemic.
We are 4 months into the global rollout, and 4 out of 5 of the doses that have been distributed so far have gone to just 9 nations.
What are those countries?
The United States, China, United Kingdom, India, Brazil, Turkey, Israel, Germany, Russia, and the United Arab Emirates. So by and large, countries with resources in advance purchased doses, so they have gotten the earliest doses.
I know the United States, under former President Trump, wanted to make sure that all the vaccine processing and ingredients and even some components like glass vials were made in America. But that didn't work out at all. The supply chains we rely on are international and interconnected.
But we're also interconnected with the spread of the virus. It's a pandemic. No one is safe until everyone's safe. It sounds like a cliche, but it's very much true.
Indeed, your report outlines several dimensions of interconnection.
So there is the humanitarian and moral issue that your access to life-saving medicines shouldn't be determined by the country of your birth or where you happen to reside. That's the moral issue. The health issue is that while this virus continues to spread, it's going to put unvaccinated people at risk everywhere, but also because of the emergence of these new variants, like we've seen emerging out of Brazil or South Africa or the United Kingdom and the U.S. Some of these variants are more deadly, they spread more easily and can be more resistant to vaccines. The third reason is economic. We're all interconnected, and if the economies of other nations suffer because they don't have an ability to bring the pandemic under control, all nations suffer.
Your report also highlighted the geopolitical aspect of this issue.
At the end of the day, if within a global crisis, there is a life-saving intervention in which it was in every nation's interest to share, and we don't, what are our prospects of global cooperation occurring on addressing future pandemic threats, climate change, nuclear nonproliferation, any collective action challenge that depends on nations working together to solve?
That's Thomas Boyke, Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations and co-director of its independent task force on preparing for the next pandemic. He spoke with my colleague, Adam Phillips. United Nations data from around the world show that the secondary effects of the COVID-19 pandemic have been particularly devastating for women and children. Government responses to the pandemic have pushed millions of women and children into poverty, erased gains in education for girls, and increased vulnerability to domestic violence and hunger. Helga Folkstad is the executive director of the World Health Organization's Partnership for Maternal, Newborn, and Child Health. She recently spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about these knock-on effects and what needs to be done about them.
So recent data from 105 countries that WHO has studied, 90% have experienced disruptions to health services because of COVID. So especially with low and income countries, reporting the greatest difficulties with immunization and family planning services being hit the hardest. So you really have inequities increasing, and the UN has estimated 71 million people are being pushed back into poverty, and I think it's 47 million are women and girls. And as I said, childhood vaccination, most disrupted service among the countries studied, with a significant drop in numbers of children fully vaccinated. For example, in Liberia, a 35% drop. Nigeria, 13% drop. So this is absolutely serious. And what we're seeing now is the early estimates of the indirect impact of COVID on child and maternal mortality indicate that more than 2 million additional children and mothers' deaths above pre-pandemic levels are estimated to occur over the 12-month period from, I think, 2020 into 2021 because of disruption of essential health and nutritional services. So the latest available data from WHO and partners revealed that also violence against women remains devastatingly pervasive and starts alarmingly young. So some 736 million women, that translates to a third of all women, have been subjected to physical or sexual violence across their lifetimes. And this is, you know, increased and by the COVID-19 pandemic, because women are locked into their houses and children too, and girls.
What do you think, other than providing health coverage, how else should governments in Africa and elsewhere, how should they address these needs?
So I think, first of all, I think the it has to be made explicit, women, children, and girls, and their needs need to be really be highlighted. I think we need to be. It requires leadership, firm yet compassionate leadership, leading the change, walking the talk for every woman and every girl and every adolescent and child. So I think although the direct effects of COVID are devastating, the indirect ones of the pandemic are less immediately visible, but are more devastating and need attention. So the pandemic has also showed, you know, that the leadership guided by evidence and true care about people can achieve, and how devastating it is when populistic and decisive issues are brought up. So I think that the crisis needs to be really focused on making clear that we have solutions not only around making services accessible, but also the safety of women and also of children, and to make sure that areas in regards to their food security and also their safety.
That was Helga Fogstad with the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn and Child Health. She was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. Ms. Fogstad's organization is working with partner groups to gather data to help government and AIDS groups to better understand the need created by pandemic and the solutions that women and adolescents want. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofoedu in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.